friends. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, and welcome to our program, our podcast, our radio cast, combination of all of that. Glad you're with me. I was out last week, as it turned out, and I thank Brett Kunkel, my esteemed friend and colleague, for filling in for me. That was 2 weeks ago? Really? What happened last week? I wasn't here last week either. Oh, I know what happened. Okay, that was 2 weeks ago. Well, thank you for 2 weeks ago. And last week, we probably had a fill-in broadcast that I did some other time, but I was not in studio on Tuesday because I was in Cedarville, Ohio, right in the middle of the cornfields at this wonderful university there, Cedarville University, a Christian school, fabulous people. They have, you know, I spoke at chapel and also for a conference that they had on tactics. It was a tactics broadly construed because there were different speakers doing different things that had to do with kind of being tactical and engagement, but my particular role was the tactical game plan proper, and I spoke at their chapel, and there were 3,000 people in their chapel, and then apparently there were another 3,000 people that were watching on video either at that moment or sometime subsequent to it. So I had a huge, I think that's the biggest audience I've ever spoken to, frankly. But it was great, and I was able to talk about some of the foundational notions of tactics and then preview the two more plenary sessions that I was going to have that afternoon and invite people to come to that, and we had a good turnout for that as well. So I had a great time there. And, you know, I frequently, at least yearly, talk about how you choose a Christian school, and I talk about a handful of factors that are really important, questions to ask about the Christian school you're going to. And characteristically, I ask questions about their understanding of the authority of Scripture, and I'm looking for something like inerrancy. I'm concerned about their view about Jesus as Savior, and is he first among equals, pluralism, or some form of inclusivism, where you don't have to believe in Jesus to be saved. You can believe other religions, and Jesus will still save you. That's the Roman Catholic view right now on this, on the issue of religious pluralism. Or do they believe what Jesus said, that he is the only way of salvation, and clearly what he intended and meant there, and what is exemplified by the disciples who followed him, was that personal faith in Jesus was necessary. It wasn't adequate to follow a false religion with strong intentions and full sincerity, and that's all you needed to qualify for the forgiveness that only Jesus can provide. That's inclusivism. No, Paul says regarding the Jews, I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God. This is Romans 10, I think. But not according to knowledge. In other words, their zeal is misdirected in a false direction, where Christ is the end of the law, he says, for those who believe. And so, anyway, that was the second issue. The third issue is their view about homosexuality and the gender concerns, because that tells me whether, as a school, this Christian group is capitulating to public pressure to be like the world. And so that's what I wanted to know about that. When I want you to be thinking about that when you go to a school that identifies as Christian. And the fourth thing that I am concerned about, and you should be concerned about too, is their view about Darwinian evolution. Do they advance theistic evolution of some sort? And if they do, I'll tell you what's going to be a casualty there is historical Adam is going to be a casualty. And an historical Adam is central to our whole project. No Adam, no fall. No fall, no need for a Savior. No need for a Savior, no need for Jesus, at least not the Jesus of the Gospels. So these things are all four really important. So I identify different schools, and there's not that many that I'm familiar with, that are safe bets on all four. I mentioned Cal Baptist here in Southern California. I mentioned Biola, of course. I mentioned some of those that have fallen from grace over the years, like Azusa, which was my alma mater in 1976. and others, and you know this, the trail is long with the wreckage of schools that have abandoned the foundations and so and gone left theologically towards progressive Christianity or whatever. The school that I was in last week, Cedarville University, was fabulous. In fact, I spent time with the dean, who is my host, and I just went through each one of these things. I said, tell me what you guys think about this. What do you teach about this? What do you guys believe about this? What do your teachers, instructors, and professors profess about these things? Turns out they have a very, very theologically high statement of faith that all of the professors, all of the instructors have to sign and show fealty to, fidelity to, faithfulness to. And it also turns out at this wonderful school, every undergraduate student has, as a minor, Bible. That's how committed they are to the process. So if you're thinking about schools for yourself or for your children or your grandchildren that are solid Christian schools, everything that I saw last week at Cedarville University was good. So I just want to commend them to you for your consideration, and I thank them for their tremendous hospitality and giving me a shot at their massive chapel service, chapel every day, 5 days a week. So I got a shot, and that was really great for me. I got a chance to see Melinda today, and it's been a while since I've seen her. And I wanted to give you a little update because many of you are curious about it and maybe frustrated because we haven't been giving a lot of updates. And the reason we haven't been giving a lot of updates is there's not really much to update you with. So it doesn't seem like she's improved a lot in the last year or so. The last time I saw her was October 31st, All Saints Day, which is her birthday. And since then, I have not been able to get out there with my travel schedule and the fact that I live. It took me three and a half hours to drive there this morning. And I spent 20 minutes with her, and then I had to come back to the office. But she seems in good spirits today. She talked with me a lot. When I say talked, she responded a lot with yes and cordial statements that were not very profound or deep, although she did say somebody was very loquacious. I don't know where that came from, but most of the time she was just nodding, and I had asked her some questions and I got short answers. So it isn't as if she's lucid to have a conversation, but she just doesn't remember very much or think much about stuff, except for in a very superficial way. And I take that this is a result of her TBI, the traumatic brain injury. When I asked her if she remembered the last time I was there, because I saw her, I said, hi. I said, it's me. Oh, hi. And she was real happy, big smile. And I said, it's been a long time. And she said, yes. I said, do you know how long it's been? And she immediately said, 4 months. So she got that one right. It would have been nice for me if she would not have remembered that particular detail. But she took it in stride, and she wasn't angry or anything. She was just happy to see me. And so we talked for a while. But then I asked her about the names of my daughters, and she wasn't able to get them right off. So that gives you a little bit of a cameo, a picture of where she's at. She's actually going to have some special testing at UCLA about a week from now, and they're going to make some more decisions about possible physical therapy or occupational therapy or something to help her out. But just wanted to let you know the circumstances just a little bit. I wish there was more that I had to report, but there's not. It is what it is, and I thank you for your prayers and your financial support for her, and we'll just stay at it as her friends and see what the Lord does. But there you have that. Now, this is Tuesday. On Thursday, I get an airplane with a whole bunch of Standard Reason staff. We fly to Dallas for our Dallas Rethink. And I just found out we are just a few people short of 1,800 young people signing up in advance for Rethink. there's always a bunch to sign up at the end. So chances are we're going to fill that place. Holds 2,000. If you have not signed up yet and you're thinking about going to our wonderful conference in North Dallas at Cottonwood Creek Church, Cottonwood Creek Church. Looking for the exact town. I guess I don't have it in front of me. But Friday night, all day Saturday, the Stand to Reason team will be there. We'll also have Frank Turek, Christopher Ewan, J. Warner Wallace, all part of our team. They're doing the best that we can to pass the baton to the next generation. I have frequently said the most important generation is the next generation, and we want to help you, parents, grandparents, pass the baton to your kids. We can't do it for you, but we can help out, and that's what Rethink has been about. And this Rethink in Dallas and also the Rethink in Alabama is the last Rethinks where we're going to use that name, as it turns out. Just putting you on advance alert that we're going to, we have a new name for Rethink, and there are some legal reasons why we had to do that. But in any event, Rethink Dallas coming up in just a couple of days. If you go to RethinkApologetics.com, you can get all the skinny there on the Dallas event Friday night, February 28th, Saturday, February 29th. I'll actually be speaking there at Cottonwood Creek Church on Sunday, March 1st. Oh, there it is. It's in Allen, Texas. So that's North Dallas area. And it looks like what we're doing is the pastor and I are going to be sitting down each service and having an open Q&A session, which is always fun for me. Incidentally, I will also be on March 17th in Louisville, Kentucky at the Reach conference there. And the weekend before that, I will be, let me see where it is. Couple days before that. I know I'm doing two things there. You have to check on my, I'll be in Dayton, Ohio. So check my schedule. If you're in Louisville, Tuesday, March 17th, and in the weekend just prior to that, let me see if I have that here somewhere. I'll be in Dayton, Ohio. I don't have the details. So go to str.org and look for staff, find my picture, and then you can find my schedule there and you get all the information. But I hope to see you at Cottonwood Creek Church this weekend for the Rethink there, and it's going to be a full house because they hold about 2,000, just like Calvary Chapel Costa Mesa, and we filled that out 2 years ago. We had to start using overflow there, and we'll be doing the same this September when we reprise the Rethink in Southern Cal. But right now, Dallas is almost filled up, so be sure to go to that website and sign up and be part of that. Oh, I love Rethinks. They are just so much fun. They are so great. Okay. While I was at Cedarville, there was a Q&A session during the conference, and there was a question that was raised I want to talk with you about just a bit. That is one of the hardest questions in my view nowadays to navigate. It's not so much theologically problematic. It is just difficult to navigate the challenges of a changing culture that has adopted a way of understanding things about reality that are very different from reality and consequently very different from God's revelation. Here I'm speaking specifically of sexual issues and gender issues. And I'm amazed, to be honest with you, I really am, at the surge and the force that gender dysphoria has taken the public attention. I thought after same-sex marriage was made legal, Obergefell in the Supreme Court, I thought, okay, that now this group has what it wants, and it will quiet down and kind of leave the rest of us alone. But this wasn't enough. Within a week after that decision, once the celebration had calmed down a little bit about Obergefell, then we started seeing aggressive moves regarding gender dysphoria. Now, gender dysphoria is a tragic thing when it happens. It usually sets up very early in life, and it's very difficult to deal with. And that's when an individual who is one sex is dysphoric about that. In other words, they feel bad about being identified with the sex their so-called biological sex, and they feel that they are in their souls, if you will, are a different sex. So a child born male believes he's female and then wants to live out his life as if he's a female. Now, of course, what's happened is that the culture has accepted the idea that beliefs are reality. So whatever you believe about yourself, that is the real circumstance. That is the real case. In fact, it's taken on such aggressive proportions that the ACLU has declared, as a matter of fact, that men can have babies. Men menstruate, men can lactate. Actually, that's biological males can lactate. But you get my point here. Men menstruate, they lactate, and they have babies. Wait a minute, I thought women did that. No, these are women who believe they're men, and so because they believe they're men, they are men, and therefore men have babies, and men menstruate. This is the direction things are going. Now, this presents a difficulty for us as followers of Christ, because we are confronting a culture that is moving in aggressively in a direction that is contrary to God's purposes and therefore contrary to reality. And so the question is, how do we deal with this? And a question came up during the Q&A, and the question was, when someone believes that they are a gender different from their biological sex, how ought we address them? Now, we know what the culture is saying. You address them by their preferred pronouns. Although that's a little odd because we don't ever address a person with a pronoun, because pronouns are used for third-person address or reference, not for first-person reference. So I don't talk to you and say, hi, he. But maybe the parallel there is, do we use the name that they prefer that is identified with, say, a male or a female pronoun, contrary to their biological sex? Now, this is a very timely question. It's an important one, and it's timely because we confront this all the time now. The reason we confront this so much, and here's it's an odd reason, is because even though genuine gender dysphoria happens very early, and it is a very small sliver of the population that suffers from this, and by the way, I'm using my words advisedly, they do suffer. In fact, they tell us this. It's the dysphoria. It's an anguish about their own biological sex. And this is why they want to make some changes. They want to transition socially and eventually physically, as far as that's possible, into their preferred gender. And so the question is then, how are we to deal with this as Christians? And I found that it's helpful if we distinguish three different categories in this assessment, okay? And we're going to go to break now, but I want to come back. And before I go to calls, I want to look at those three different categories, because you need to be prepared to address in a generous and a gracious but a truthful fashion this trend. And I started making a comment about how gender dysphoria is actually kind of rare, but it's becoming less rare for a particular reason. I'll explain that when I return here at Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
What comes into our mind when we think about God is the most important thing about us. Everyone has ideas about God. Unfortunately, many people hold false ideas about him. And these ideas have consequences. Some false ideas have led people to worship a God of their own making, while others have led people to reject God altogether. This year, we've devoted an entire conference to answering the most common false ideas about God. Is God anti-gay? Is God good? Do Muslims and Christians worship the same God? These are just a few of the topics we'll be addressing. The only way to guard against false ideas is to fill our minds with true ideas. So join me and a number of other speakers at one of this year's Rethink Apologetics student conferences. Find out more information about Rethink by going to rethinkapologetics.com. That's rethinkapologetics.com.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
All righty, Greg Kokel back at you here at Stand to Reason, talking about gender dysphoria and how we navigate this very difficult issue in our culture. And I was saying that genuine gender dysphoria is actually kind of rare, the kind that starts when you're young and then there's a struggle with it, etc. And it's hard to deal with. Look, I'm pausing here. I'm going to say it's hard to correct. But I caught myself pausing, like I'm thinking, well, that's not a politically correct way to say it. It's hard to correct as if something's wrong. Of course something is wrong. I'm chastising myself for my pause there, my reluctance to say it like it is. Of course something is wrong. Everybody knows that. Even the people suffering from gender dysphoria, they know something's wrong. There is a disconnect between their soul and what they think, or what they, this is the way they might characterize, or at least a disconnect between their belief about their gender and their biological sex. All right? But it's actually gotten worse because of the development of what's called rapid onset gender dysphoria, ROGD, rapid onset gender dysphoria. Well, what's that? That's a social contagion. What do I mean by that? I mean that it has become cool in our culture among young people to be gender dysphoric. And so consequently, when people start feeling during adolescence kind of their angst and uneasiness with life, which is pretty normal, they start thinking, well, maybe the problem is that I'm gender dysphoric. And because they get so much encouragement from their culture on this issue, they start moving that direction. And so consequently, rather than having something develop deeply and slowly over time, this has become kind of a cultural fad, a social contagion, as one writer put it. Much like cutting is a social contagion. Kids do it because other people do it. And this seems like a cool way of expressing their angst. Now, I don't think they're enjoying it necessarily. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that people pick this up from other people who do this, and it's part of their culture. And so they climb on board. They mimic their culture. So now we've got... And then we've got a culture that's massively promoting the legitimacy of gender dysphoria as if what the person conjures or thinks or believes in their own mind is what reality is. That's the real world. So this puts us in a difficult spot because on the one hand, as Christians, we have a biblical issue that we're dealing with. On the other hand, we have a cultural issue and even a policy issue as the government is stepping in or government agencies like educational systems and passing either laws or policies that are enforceable at the local level. So you have those two areas, the biblical issue and the cultural policy issue. Then you have the personal issue, which was really what generated the question that I was asked. How do you deal with this when you're talking to a person? Do you use their preferred pronouns or references or names, or do you talk about them according to their biological sex? Now, this is a hard situation because I know Christians are trying to navigate through a tough circumstance. You don't want to seem mean-spirited. At the same time, you want to be faithful to the truth, okay? So let me just talk very briefly about these three areas. And it may be that some of you won't agree with me on these distinctions that I'm making or even the advice that I give, but that's okay. Here's the biblical area. What does the Bible teach? What is God's understanding of these things? What is the nature of reality? Now, this is something we have to be very clear on. And the reason we have to be clear on this is because the world is pushing back very, very aggressively on this particular issue. What is the nature of reality? And the world is saying reality is what's in your mind, not what's in the world, as it were. Reality is determined by mind-dependent, subjective beliefs. They are not determined by mind-independent, objective states of affairs. Your body is what your body is. That's it. That's the objective world. The subjective world is what you believe. And what the culture is saying is, you are what you believe. That's reality. And that's not what God says. And one of the easiest ways to make this point biblically, I think, is to look at Jesus. Now, this is a tactic I call, what a friend we have in Jesus. In other words, we allow Jesus to make our point for us when possible because he's got more credibility than we do. And so at this point, I want to go back to, say, Matthew 19 and to show what Jesus had to say about this because most people respect Jesus. And here's what he said regarding divorce and remarriage. He answered that question by going back to the beginning and identifying God's purpose and plan for the sexes and for marriage and for sexuality. It's all covered there. And to sum up what he said in terms of God's plan out of Genesis chapter 2, here's what he said. He said, marriage is one man with one woman becoming one flesh for one lifetime. Some of you have heard me say this before, but I'm going to do it again. One man with one woman becoming one flesh for one lifetime. Remember, the one flesh, that's sex. So notice a couple of things here. According to Jesus, sex is binary according to Jesus. There are men and there are women. There are males and there are female. He created them male and female. That's stated in Genesis 1. I think it's repeated and it's repeated at least once in Genesis 2, maybe twice. And we see that playing out as the man and the woman join themselves sexually in a union that is lifelong in a relationship that we identify now as marriage. Do you notice that what Jesus says there, one man with one woman becoming one flesh for one lifetime, covers all the controversial issues, not only gender dysphoria, that is, your gender is what your sex is. And if you're dysphoric about it, okay, we live in a fallen world, but reality is not in your dysphoria or in your mind, what your mind tells you, it is in what your body says. And in fact, that can never be changed. Sex change operations are not possible. You can do cosmetic surgery. You can take hormones. You can mutilate or carve or cut up or remove parts of the body, but you can never change your sex because it's in every cell of your body. So Jesus is identifying, first of all, sex as binary, and then he identifies marriage as between a man and a woman, and it's in that context that sexual union is appropriate because there's protection in there, because it's for a lifetime. What God has joined together, let no man tear asunder, is what Jesus said. Notice that in that formula, all forms of sexual contact or interaction that are prohibited from the scriptures are covered by that statement, because all those forms of sex, which are adultery, fornication, homosexuality, and bestiality, all prohibited in Scripture, are all types of sex you have with someone other than your lifelong spouse. So in one statement, Jesus covers all the bases. And for the people who think, well, Jesus never said anything about these things, there it is, Matthew 19. So that's the biblical record. We need to be clear on what the Bible communicates about these things, and incidentally, what the Bible says comports with our common sense understanding of reality. This is not news, what I'm saying, okay? People get this. They don't always follow it, but for eons, it's been pretty self-evident. When it comes to the cultural issue, though, we can't quote the Bible because people don't care about that. But I want to give you an insight. If God says it's wrong, or if God identifies some behaviors outside of what is good, remember he looked at all that he made and said it was good, then there's something bad that will befall us if we do the non-good thing. And we may be able to, with a little reflection and insight, figure out the bad that befalls us and use that as a basis for a policy or cultural concern. Now, I just happen to know, by the way, that the attempted suicide rate just across the board, generally, is about 1.7%, something like that, just below, it's sub 2. The attempted suicide rate for gender dysphoric people is 41%. Yeah, let that sink in. What that means is almost half of the people who are gender dysphoric try to kill themselves. Now, that's not good. That is 20 times the national average. Why is the attempted suicide rate so high in those cases? Now, I know what the standard thing to say. Well, it's because there's so much oppression, particularly from Christians who won't accept these things, that this drives them to suicide. Well, that's a possible explanation, but let me just point out, simply saying it's the reason doesn't make it the reason. One's got to demonstrate that this is, in fact, the reason that almost half of gender dysphoric people are trying to commit suicide. I don't think that's the reason, partly because even in cultures like in Sweden, where you don't have that kind of cultural pressure, you still have really high suicide or attempted suicide rates. It does not seem to be that. I think it's something different. I think it's the awareness that there's something gone wrong, and that's distressing on its own. Which, by the way, as I mentioned, they already acknowledge something has gone wrong. That's their point. That's why they want to transition socially and biologically to another gender. Okay? So if the attempted suicide rate is 20 times the national average for those who are gender dysphoric, why would we want to encourage gender dysphoria? Now, I'm not quoting a Bible verse. I'm just trying to use a common sense notion here. Why would we want to encourage gender dysphoria? Because that's exactly what's going on in our culture. I had a student tell me this last week, that a friend of hers was in the process of transitioning to a new gender, and she mentioned to me, part of it is that it's a fad. It's cool to be gender dysphoric. That's the social contagion element that I was talking about. And so why are we making it cool to be in a very sad situation? A situation so sad that nearly half of those in that situation attempt suicide. Why would we want to encourage that? Why not rather encourage help so that their mental frame of mind matches their physical body? That seems to me that makes more sense. But did you know in quite a number of states now, that's actually illegal to do? State of California, state of New Jersey, and others. It's illegal to get help for a minor, counseling for a minor in this regard. So what I've said is there's three areas here when we answer how we deal with this issue. One is biblical. We got to get clear on what reality is like. And God tells us that, and what he tells us comports with common sense. Secondly, we have to deal with the cultural issue and the policy issue. When we're talking in the abstract about these issues, we should argue for what's good and right and true and safe. But the middle category is the personal one. When you're engaging an individual and on this issue, or let's put it this way, you're socially involved with the individual in some way that is gender dysphoric and has transitioned, at least socially, into another gender. How do you address them? And it's Standard Reason we've gone back and forth and back and forth on this issue. But I think where we've landed, at least as far as that question is concerned, is it's probably best to address that person with their preferred name and preferred gender. And I'll tell you why. I was late to the table on this one, because in my view, I'm thinking we have to hang on to what is true, and it isn't true that that a male is a female, even if the male believes he's a female. It's not true. But then I had to ask myself the question, in the circumstance I just described, in the social involvement individual circumstance, the personal circumstance, not the biblical thing, we've got to be clear there. Not the cultural thing, we've got to be clear there. But on the personal issue, what will happen if we insist on using names and gender terms that don't comport with the self concept of that individual? You know what it's going to look like? Like we're nasty and we're mean. Now, I think sometimes we just have to draw a line in the sand and say, no, we're not crossing this line. And if you want me to call me nasty and mean and whatever, okay, well, then you're going to, then that's up to you. But here I stand, I could do no other kind of thing. But I don't think that this particular thing, gender references to individual personal people in a relational circumstance, is the place to draw that line. Certainly in the church. Certainly with regards to the Bible, certainly with regards to the culture in those two areas. But when it comes to personal interaction, I don't want to just merely appear to come across mean-spirited. I want to give room for communication of the truth instead of just acting in a way that the other person will consider insulting. Mean-spirited. There are times when I have to live with that because the issue is big enough, but I don't think this circumstance is. The issue is big, certainly, but the circumstantial situation, I don't think is. Now, you may disagree, and you're free to do that. And I think each person should follow his own conscience in this. But that's the recommendation we're giving now. We're still in flux on this, and there is a circumstance. We had a lot of discussion at our staff meeting today. What happens when it's your own child? You know, then what? And there are qualifiers for that, too, and there was helpful interaction on that. I'm not going to try to answer that now. It's been a longish commentary, so I want to go to calls shortly. But I'm encouraging you to think about this issue and maybe others that are like this in different categories. We got to be clear on the biblical issue, but just being clear on the biblical issue doesn't always answer how we're going to engage people on a personal basis. And it may not always answer how we comport ourselves in the culture. I'm not sure. It just depends. But we have to answer the biblical issue first to figure out what reality is actually like. And I think usually that's just going to comport with a common sense view and understanding of the way the world actually is. That is, you don't always have to read the Bible to figure these things out. And once you do that, once you have a fix on what reality is like, then the question is, policy-wise, culture-wise, what's the best way to maneuver to make a difference for the good? And on an individual, personal basis, what's the appropriate way to navigate with grace? And again, people may come up with different understandings on those last two things, and that's okay. Let's work it out. We're working on it. And everyone ultimately has to decide for themselves. But I hope those categories will help you to navigate more effectively. Let's go to break, then to your calls on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
All right, friends, it just occurred to me that I have a prayer request. I'm not thinking too much about it, but next week, and this is why it just occurred to me now, but a week from today, that will be Tuesday at 8:30 in the morning, Los Angeles time, I'm going under the knife for what's called an ablation, A-B-L-A-T-I-O-N. Now, that's a heart procedure. They go up through my femoral arteries with fancy instruments and go into my heart, and then they work on the electricity there and even things out so I don't go into AFib, which is a irregular heartbeat that I go into on occasion. So many of you know what I'm talking about because you've had them. They're somewhat routine, but they are poking around inside my heart with wires and stuff. So just so you know, I would appreciate prayer for success for the surgery, and I don't want the surgery just to be a success. I don't want the patient to die either. Yes, the surgery was a success, but the patient died. No, I want both. All right, you get it. So that's March 3rd, 8:30 in the morning, Los Angeles time. So just saying. Thank you for that in advance. All right, let's go to Rockland, Maine, and this is Oliver. Hello, Oliver.
Hey, Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing good now. In a week, I don't know. We'll see. But I'm actually looking forward to it because I'm going to get a really good day's rest.
Yeah. Oh, man.
I love it when they turn that valve and I just fade out. That's nice. Everybody loves the anesthesiologist.
I'll keep you in my prayers for sure. Hey, so my question here is, when I've heard atheists use, is, are we just physical, like brain, neurons, and chemicals, or do we have a soul? And something the atheists might use to try to prove the we're just physical stance is like people who get certain brain injuries, they never recover. Like there's an example of a man, I don't know where it happened, but he got a railroad spike in the head.
Right.
And after that, he was completely changed. He became like an angry man.
Sure.
And stuff like that.
Sure.
And so that's my question for you. How would I refute this?
Well, I know a lot about these issues and some of these illustrations, and what you just described is called the mind-body problem. Is there a mind and a body, or is there just a body that produces an illusion that we call the mind? Because we're certainly aware of our mental states, but are those mental states just physical properties or illusions? As some atheists like Daniel Dennett say, consciousness is an illusion, which is really a strange thing for any intelligent person to say. Because when you think about what an illusion is, an illusion is some kind of distortion of a conscious state, right?
Yeah. Sure.
So only conscious things have illusions. So if consciousness is an illusion, then what is having that illusion? Is it an illusion having an illusion kind of thing? So I think that's not the right road to go down, calling consciousness an illusion. But one of the reasons that they go that direction is because they cannot reduce consciousness to the physical. So we're going to take two things as givens. One thing is our physical body is a given, and that's not in contention here with your atheist friend. The other one is our consciousness, and that is also a given because all of us are conscious beings. We're sentient. The question is, what is the nature of consciousness? We know something about the nature of the body. One aspect of the nature of the body is that it's physical.
Yep.
So physical things have physical qualities. Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay, so physical qualities are like we extend in space. You can locate, if you put a GPS on your body, you could locate that body somewhere, you know. Your body is located in space somewhere. You have physical qualities like weight, or physical things respond to the laws of physics and chemistry. Otherwise, science wouldn't work. Okay, so those are some givens about something that is physical. Okay, fair enough?
Yep.
Okay, so then the question is, what we know about the mental, and we know a lot about the mental because we are mentals. That is, we are constantly conscious, but we're not conscious, when we're asleep. Even so, it is our standard awareness. Is our awareness of our consciousness. So here's the question that needs to be asked to answer your question about whether there's a soul or not. Is or are conscious states physical things? Now, we know they were physical if they have physical qualities. So let me ask you, you are aware of talking to me on the phone right now, on the podcast, right, the show, right?
Yep.
Presumably, you're aware of that.
Okay.
Is the awareness, now I'm choosing my words very carefully, is the awareness something that's physical? And then to answer that question, we just have to ask, does it extend in space? Does it have a physical location? Does it have a weight? Does it respond to the laws of physics and chemistry? And I think the answer to each of those questions is no. Your awareness is not a chemical reaction. It isn't physics that is the awareness. It doesn't extend in space. It has no weight. It whatever it is, it doesn't have those physical qualities. You with me?
Yeah.
So if it doesn't have physical qualities, it probably isn't physical. Fair enough?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the simplest way, I think, to go about to demonstrate that our mental states are not the same as physical states, because mental states have mental properties and physical states have physical properties, and they're very different. Okay,
yeah.
So what is having my mental states? Well, the thing that's having my mental states is a mental self. That's what a soul is. Okay, so now I understand the pushback. The pushback is, wait a minute, when I do things to the physical body that affects my mental states? And the answer is yes, of course. Mm-hmm. If we do something to the physical, say, to the brain, that is going to have a consequence in our mental abilities in some way, and if we do something to our in our soul, that can have an impact on the physical body. But does the fact that the physical body can affect consciousness, or consciousness can affect the physical body, does that by itself show that consciousness is the physical body?
No. I don't.
You're correct. The answer is no. Just because one influences the other doesn't mean one is the other.
Mm-hmm.
All right? I mean, look, I could push you. If you're standing here, I can give you a shove.
Yes.
Okay, I caused something to happen to you, but that doesn't mean I'm you.
Yeah.
The same thing is true here. If we can clarify that there are mental states that don't have physical qualities and physical states that have physical qualities, then we realize that there's mental and physical and they're separate. Mm-hmm. And I have a physical body and I have a mental self. Mm-hmm. Do they interact? Sure. You put a stake through my brain, something's going to happen because my brain is what my soul uses.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess in a way our souls are tied to our brains, you know, like that, I guess would be
a good way of putting
it.
Yeah, there's a union. Okay. Now, the way J.P. Moreland, who wrote an excellent little booklet on the soul, it's called The Soul. It's a Ravi Zacharias International Ministry, RZIM booklet. But he's written quite a few things on this issue, okay? And in that, he clarifies what it means for something to be physical and for something to be mental or soulish. And he shows the qualities are different, so they're not the same. But he does show that they're interrelated. So let me see. Like, you could feel hungry and therefore make a decision with your soul to eat something to satisfy your hunger. So there, your physical body is having an influence on your soulish behavior. It doesn't determine it necessarily in that case, but it does have an influence. Now, you could also, Proverbs says, a cheerful heart doeth good like a medicine, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you know that it's a fairly common notion that when people, if they're physically down or whatever, if they can be stimulated mentally to help them cheer up, they're going to feel better physically, right? Let's go to a ball game. Let's do this or do that or whatever. And, you know, and physically you start feeling better. You feel better mentally too, but you feel better physically. I'm just trying to think of some examples, not only where the physical, what happens to the physical body affects what happens to the soul, but where what happens to the soul affects what happens to the physical body. Okay? There is some significant research out that shows that, and it's interesting to look at this. Apparently, this started when a guy had a diagnosis of terminal cancer. So he figured if he's going to die, he's going to go out laughing. And so what he did is he rented every Marx Brothers movie and every comedy, this and that and the other thing, because he just wanted to listen to all this, see all this funny stuff. So he's laughing all the time, and he got better.
What?
So, you mean his mental state improved? I'm not offering this as a new medication or a panacea for everybody that's got cancer, but there's a lot of people who can tell you that the way you think about yourself can have an effect on your physical body and even on disease. So that shows there's interaction between body and soul and between soul and body, even though the soul is not the body and the body is not the soul. You see, all the steak illustration or anecdote shows us is that physical trauma to the brain can affect mental activity.
Mm-hmm.
I visited Melinda today, and she's had TBI, traumatic brain injury. And because she has traumatic brain injury, her soul can't get out the way it used to be, used to get out when her brain was healthy.
I see.
So the way J.P. Moreland characterizes it is it's kind of like you have a driver in a car. The car is not going to go anywhere without the driver. The driver gets out of the car, and the car does nothing. That, by the way, is a corpse, if you're following the illustration, because the body and the car are analogous, and the driver and the soul are analogous. When the soul leaves the body is dead. Okay? However, when the driver is in the car, if the car is not functioning properly, then it's not going to go anywhere either, even though the driver is really plenty alert and plenty capable of doing the driving if the car worked.
Yeah.
So this is an analogy to show, to help people see how the two are interrelated, even though they are not the same thing. We know they are not the same thing, not because I can give you an analogy like I just did. We know they're not the same thing because they don't have the same qualities or properties. Physical things have physical properties. Mental things have mental properties. We know they're different. And so, and we also know from experience how one interacts with the other. And so the car illustration is a good illustration to help us to see how this can be the case.
That's a good analogy. I do like, that's a good one.
Yeah, I do too. It's not mine, it's JP's, but I think it's a good one as well. So you might try this on your atheist friend. I have had lots of conversations with physicalist type people, people who believe that there is no soul, it's only a brain, and they are reluctant to let go of that idea. And what they characteristically will do is give example after example after example about how soulish capacities or functions are impaired by something physical. But that's perfectly consistent with my view. And it doesn't mean just because a spike goes through the brain and people have their personality changes, their personalities change, that doesn't mean that their brain is their personality. No, it just means that their brain is a vehicle through which their personality is expressed. And if there's something that happens to the brain, then the vehicle isn't working very well and the driver can't get out, make it do what it needs to do. Anyway, Oliver, there you go. I hope that helps. There's my music. End of this hour. Thank you for the call. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Give him heaven. Bye-bye, friends.